I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
A little something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional, unprofessional. So if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop.
A Guinness advert fascinated me as a child. "Don't look now, but I think we're about to be swallowed," one drink declared to the other, an uneasy grin on its frothy cream head. I can recognise its discomfort. Like many people who've lived through the 60s, I feel that my memories of what happened then have been swallowed several times over. This disjuncture between memory and interpretation is not only an inevitable consequence of time passing, it's arisen because as the hopeful, radical promise of the 60s became stranded, it was variously dismissed as ridiculous, sinister, impossibly utopian, earnest, terrible thing to be, or immature. Running through the outer story of my own political radicalization is a troubled questioning of what it meant to be a woman long before women's liberation surfaced as a movement. Young women like myself on the nexus of popular culture and left politics were profoundly affected by the broader shifts in society. At the same time, our beliefs and activism meant that we were caught in an uncomfortable gap between the manifold aspects of femininity, our personal destiny, and a public discourse about democracy and equality. This divide was lived and experienced as a private discordance which seemed apart from politics, the contradictory personal perceptions which resulted and were working their way beneath the surface of many women's lives rarely appear in historical accounts of the 60s, and in the case of working class women and the growing numbers of Asian and Afro-Caribbean women workers who were becoming active in the unions and community politics even less. Where, despite our very high-fluting ideas about how we were going to transform ourselves and personal sexual relationships, we were so ignorant. I mean, I don't think anyone could imagine how ignorant we were who didn't live in those times. I mean, I wrote to some friend, Tony Kay, who's actually here, I knew from 1960. I said, this is after I'd lost my virginity. I said, are you a virgin, A, when the penis is inserted into the vagina, B, when you have an orgasm? Because I couldn't understand why there was such a fuss about this penis going in. And the orgasm must be the key, I thought. But I had no idea. But I met at university, fortunately, I met a very rational maths graduate, Bob Rowthorne, who took me under control as far as knowledge about birth control, because he was very good at calculating safe periods. And he found out about someone called Mary Adams, who was unusually enlightened Fabian socialist doctor, this is about 1962, who would fit diaphragms for young unmarried women. I was so nervous when I arrived for my appointment that they thought I must be pregnant. A brisk, posh-voiced Mary Adams reassured me by chatting away as she demonstrated how to squirt the jelly into the brown rubber diaphragm. Her mother had been a militant suffragette, and she'd once waited in trepidation because, like Guy Fawkes, her mother had planned to blow up Parliament. Unlike Guy Fawkes, however, she was never caught. You remind me of my friend Ellen Wilkinson, declared Mary Adams, shaking her head and washing her hands. I'd not heard of the red-haired left-wing MP who led funga marches then. But the idea of a long legacy of rebel women arrived with my diaphragm. Freedom from sexual fear combined with political subversion. Always take it with you, Mary Adams admonished me as I turned to go. Even if you just go for a walk in the woods. In 1963, I went on Aldermaston, the march for the campaign for nuclear disarmament, and a group of us, about 1,000 of us, broke off to show where the regional seat of government was hidden, which was secret places that were there to preserve people who were the elite. And when I got back to Leeds, which is where I came from, I wore my CND badge, which was briefly to be a declaration of wild extremity with pride. I had turned into a kind of collective outsider now. People fell away from me in W.H. Smith in Leeds. We touched a twitchy nerve of state security and were denounced as hoodlums in the newspapers. My Tory father, on the other hand, responded with unexpected pride. He'd heard that the military police had been called to disperse us, and he hated them. He'd no time for ban the bombers or pacifists, but he thought the invasion showed grit and moral courage. My cousin Anne's laughing. She remembers Lance Rowbotham. In the late 60s, the intensity of politics really accelerates. And people will know that was the time when Enoch Powell made this speech, the racist speech about anti-immigration. I was really anxious about Powell. And I joined the International Socialists, which I stayed in for about 18 months. But at that time, it seemed really important to be in some kind of coherent force, because we thought that some kind of fascist movement was going to arrive. And when I went to teach at the Further Education College, the Port of London Authority messenger boys, a few days after Powell's speech, they stood up as I entered, giving the fascist salute. We battled through the lesson, but there was no budging them. However, one boy, an ironic football enthusiast who usually seemed half asleep, was not having any of it. He'd been arguing every day at work on the docks non-stop. His quiet courage was impressive. It was him and me against the rest. I used everything I could fling at them, from the music they liked to appeals to human decency, and to ridicule at being taken for a ride by a man who was contemptuous of the working class. We argued for several weeks, and it was eventually to be the information on the flyer for a new radical newspaper called Black Dwarf, which Tariq Ali was editing, that dented their support for Powell. Along with a big picture of Powell in Nazi uniform, it revealed that he supported 3% unemployment as a solution to inflation. They were so enraged at this, these confident young workers, that he ceased to be their hero. towards the end of 68, there were discussions about the position of women on Black Dwarf, and I was to do a women's Black Dwarf issue with Fred Halliday. Fred was appointed because he'd read Reich and knew about psychology, and I because I just kept on talking, I think. Anyway, I sat on my stool in the basement by the gas fire in the Hackney communal house where I lived, writing furiously. Out came all the concentrated thoughts and impressions which had been unconsciously accumulating. They just boiled up. And I realised that I must write from my own observations and feelings. And that was quite a scary feeling at the end of 68, to write from your own subjective feelings. But that wider cultural shift towards subjectivity was partly responsible, because I'd been hearing it in the music ever since the Beatles sang Help at the end of 1965. And it joined to the outer world of politics already at that time, in the politics of black power that was coming over from the States and influencing groups here. I'd read other combinations of the personal and the political in Simone de Beauvoir's writing and in Doris Lessing's novels. And Karen Horney's ideas about masculine hegemony had also been playing around at the back of my mind over the last year. I made a list. Me, hairdressing girl, Brentford nylons, birth control, unmarried mothers, TUC, Usdaw, Ford's women, striptease girl. And the words just splattered out onto the pages. I went to a women's group after a conference early in 1969, when we'd had a conference at Essex, a revolutionary festival, and it was really chaotic. And a group of us got very angry when we tried to talk about women's position. And afterwards, we had a women's meeting, which we decided we wanted to have simply women there because we didn't know really what we were talking about. We wanted the space to talk, the autonomous space to talk, to try and work out things. I remember a member of the Tufnell Park group, Sue Cowley, as she then was, Sue O'Sullivan, and also another American woman called Shelley Wirtis, who went back to the States. And I was really interested because they took an approach that was very strange on the left then, in which they were arguing that new relations in the family should not be following a revolution, but they were intent on making changes in the here and now. Along with their anti-authoritarianism and belief in participatory democracy, the North American women brought into the British Women's Liberation Movement a belief in prefiguring a desired future in the way you organized. And they also possessed an openness to new realities and perceptions and a respect for knowledge rooted in experience. The influential New Left thinker C. Wright Mills had argued the need to translate personal problems into social issues. And this concept was to have a particular relevance for women. I later went to a meeting of the Tufnell Park group, and I know this sounds very funny, but all the meetings I'd ever been to were people in lines, as we are, and people behaved in a rather formal way and said, you know, I was the comrade at the back, and would the comrade at the back like to report on something or other things? And this group wasn't like that. They were sitting around in circles, and they were quietly cooperative. You could hear yourself think, and half-formed ideas could be developed collectively. The consciousness-raising approach of the early women's liberation groups could go badly wrong when a consensus coalesced into a perspective which could be hard to contest. It was actually hard to contest something if people said, I just feel it, you know. Now, what can you do? There's nothing to say. If it's just felt. So there were problems. But in the early stages of the women's movement, when the anti-authoritarian insistence on everyone participating worked, it could be magic. So finally, as we prepared for the first Women's Liberation Conference, the movement I envisaged was to be an entirely new kind of politics. No leaders, no ego trips, no more sectarian disputes. In the words of a woman trade unionist I discovered in the report of the 1968 Women's TUC Conference, we wanted more than the promise of a dream. What actually happened was to be in some ways much more than we initially imagined, and in some ways very much less, a paradox which holds true for many political and social grassroots movements.
You said that as you were writing that book, you got more and more bewildered at what you thought of as the coincidences that make up the fatalities of a very particular life. And that's what writing about one's own past does, why it's so exciting and also can be rather frightening. So what I want to say is that meeting you in the early 70s and reading almost every word you've written ever since is one of the fatalities of my life that's made my life what I want it to be. And it's not such a coincidence, though. And why it's not such a coincidence is what you will find out from reading this book if you haven't read it, because it really is, I think, the very best account of why women's liberation had to emerge. It simply had to emerge when it emerged from all that ferment of the 1960s. So let's think, first of all, why do memories disappear so fast, like the contents of that bottle of Guinness? And, you know, what the 60s is, as you say, either idealized or demonized. You know, it's either joyful and good or all bad. And of course, especially for women, but actually also very much for men, it was not that. And so do you think this is something that happens always to historical time, or something particular about the 60s?
At the time when I was writing this memoir, it did seem as though people had really lost interest in looking at movements from below. And now I feel that there's some new spirit around, and that there is suddenly this interest, because by the time I was writing this, it would be the late 90s, I think people want to get away from failure. If a movement hasn't achieved what it was hoped that it would achieve, then I think there's a way in which people don't really want to remember, because they want to. I think there's a very strong tendency that people want to remember something that's good, you know, and not to remember a movement that didn't do this, at least the social and economic changes which we imagined would come through the women's movement. It did mean that it's been easier for women to, small groups of women, to move up to a certain extent and do things that they would never have done, but not the vision of transformation which we'd imagined, in which all human relationships would change.
And then you say a lot about sexuality and the dilemmas of trying to repudiate what we saw as the nonsense of all women should remain virgins and be saving themselves for marriage, when obviously everything every film we ever saw, everything we read was all about women being as sexy as possible. But as you say, we were comprehensively ignorant, but nevertheless often trying to live and relate differently to men. But then there was this strange thing that in the end, men often didn't want us to be living and relating differently to them. If you think of Norman Mailer and his huge fears of men were going to lose out to the vibrator and so on. It was such an impossible contradiction, wasn't it? And I wonder if you feel we've got any further than the mess we felt in then.
Well, it's not a definite answer. As you get older, things change too. But I think it must be very, very hard for someone who's in their 20s now to imagine the total ignorance. And it was felt that somehow or other, if you didn't tell girls anything about sex, that it would keep them sort of pure, and then they wouldn't get into trouble. But I mean, they still, I mean, for the younger people here, there were still homes for, you know, unmarried mothers. In fact, when the women's movement started in Holland, the women went and carried flowers to the homes of unmarried mothers in homage to the women who'd had children out of marriage. But I mean, it was still seen something that was very difficult, even within quite lefty circles. It was not totally easy. You could live together okay, but to have a child, I think, was the point when that closed up.
Yeah, I'll come back to that. But of course, wanting to keep women ignorant is exactly what Trump and various men on the right today are still wanting. You know, no sex education in schools,
yes,
trying to abolish rights to abortion. So those times, you know, always people are working, certain people, particularly the rise of the right today, are working to try and bring them back. But let's get you
to... those social and cultural gains that we really did make in attitudes are really, the right now, are really challenging those
absolutely
gains. And so it's as though that territory is under attack.
Anyway, let's get you to Oxford. And although in the 60s a working class hero was something to be, it didn't seem to have quite penetrated Oxford, where you said even people on the left, and I could name them but I won't, would mock your northern Yorkshire accent. And so for a long time you felt very out of place, and also you were being taught British imperial history because as yet there'd been no big intervention. So of course that's exactly what many of the Tory party, like Gove today, would like us to be learning about in our history lessons in schools. But nevertheless, you get rescued by your encounter with those who had once been in the Communist Party, like Richard Cobb and Beryl and Bridget and Christopher Hill, and in particular then Dorothy and Edward Thompson, exactly when Edward Thompson is writing the history of the English working class. And so introducing you to a completely new way of thinking about history, of looking at collective self-consciousness and relationships and work and communities, totally different to the history that you were being taught then at Oxford. And so that's exactly what you go on to use, isn't it, when you're thinking of women's history and what it is to capture an emergent consciousness historically. Perhaps you could say a bit more on that.
Well, I got sent to... Because I wasn't doing very well, because I was acting at university in my first year, I was nearly kicked out and then got rescued by Bridget Hill, who, and through Bridget Hill, I got invited to Balliol parties, and there were left people there. They're mainly posh lefties, actually. slightly less posh one, actually, was Chris Patton, who was hanging around.
That's funny. Unlike some of the Vanguard leftists.
Yes. Yeah. But it was not, it was the content of the history we did was very much, you know, from about the kings, the treasury, and the state system. And I got sent to a tutor in Christchurch first, who was exceedingly right-wing, and didn't believe, he thought it was very terrible that Asa Briggs ever looked at newspapers. And he always called me Miss Lowbottom. And he talked about my predilection for the boards because of acting. Yeah. So that was hopeless. And then Beryl Smalley, who is a rather enlightened medievalist, decided it would be good for me to go off to a crazy anarchist. Actually, he wasn't, I don't think Rich Cobb had ever really was communist. But he was a historian who loved chaos coming from below. He just delighted. I mean, he did later move to the right, but at the time when I went there, he would sort of leap over the sofa and talk about the Spanish Civil War, and he was very eccentric. And he one day said to me, "You must go and see my friends." who are these they're always writing about Chartists, and they live in Halifax. And I went to the home of E.P. and Dorothy Thompson, and Edward was not in sight, and there was Dorothy, who was dressed in her kind of black turtleneck jumper that was a real sort of sign of being an alternative intellectual woman. And she talked to me, and they had decided that Richard, who was a ne'er-do-well and nefarious person, had got me pregnant, and I was coming to tell my woes to them. And Edward had gone into hiding in his study. Dorothy went out and said, "It's all right." Anyway, that's how I met the Thompsons. And then it became a second home, because I would go on the bus from Leeds to Halifax and just read in this amazing library of history about the socialist movement and the kinds of movements that Edward and Dorothy were studying.
Anyway, then you get your degree and you're with Bob, although you're also falling in love with various ethereal young men at the same time, so you have to deal with those complexities. But once in Hackney, where Bob decides is a place for you to move, you encounter what you describe as the solemn rituals of sectarian combat between the different Trotskyist boots that you encounter, particularly when you join the Labour Party, the Labour Youth Section, and they tell you things about who's right and who's wrong, and Popular Front, yes, United Front, no, and you say how easy it would be to get this wrong.
Of course, it's
it depends which trot you're talking to, doesn't it? But it was from you then I learnt something about these different dissident Trotskyist groups, which is something that you retain pondering about that would feed into Beyond the Fragments when we try, as we still try, to help unite the left facing Thatcher in 1979, that account of what's wrong with the vanguardist party.
I got from the Thompsons, what was really important was I got this idea that there could be another kind of left, and that it wasn't necessary to follow either the Communist Party trajectory or the Trotskyist trajectory, really. But then got immersed in Hackney Young Socialists, because I thought if you're a socialist, you shouldn't just talk, you should do things. So I joined Hackney Young Socialists, and it happened to be a place where militant and international socialists and other people were all arguing away among each other. And so most people who ever joined it always left. I used to look in hope some youths would come from Hackney, and they would look like nice kind of normal people with longish hair, and then they would hear all these people going on, and it was all very incomprehensible. But it was something that it introduced me not only to left ideas, so I had to read a lot in order to argue with everyone, but it also meant that I understood about Trotskyism as an intense sort of inner process, and I got very interested actually in the history of Trotskyist groups. I've lost track in about the 1980s.
You had a pretty good sense of it, though. But you also, in terms of your political outlook, talk about the importance of CND, and from CND and the rise and partial collapse of CND, thinking about...
There was a movement.
The significance of relating movements to party politics, to trying to influence the left of the Labour Party, although the Labour Party remained so passive, as you found, apart from those Trotskyists trying to take it over, but really mainly trying to destroy each other. But that also is surely something which has remained with you, with me, and no doubt many of us to this day, how one actually tries to build coalitions on the left.
Yes, we did. Mm-hmm. And we wanted, when we did Beyond the Fragments, this is jumping ahead, but we really wanted the understandings that we'd gained through the women's movement to be something that would be our contribution back into the left. and we wanted other rank and file grassroots movements to come with their experiences. So we wanted to turn it around, that the understanding and theorizing was coming out of the experience of movements rather than from somebody sitting there dictating to people what they should be thinking.
Yes, and also from Vietnam Solidarity Campaign, where there, as elsewhere, you're still thinking about this problem of also being a woman on the left, and that becomes particularly clear in Vietnam Solidarity Campaign, where it's always the boys who are up there on those platforms talking, and you give an account of trying to talk to them about how to raise money for the campaign. And you said, as you speak, it's as though a plane flew overhead. There's a complete silence, and then they carry on with what they were saying before you spoke. And Henry Waters, the husband of Shelley Waters, says, introduces you to the concept of male chauvinism.
Yes,
why did that disappear? We don't still use that word, but
male
chauvinism. You hadn't heard that before.
No, I didn't know about any. This was 1967, I think, when
I met
Henry.
Yes, this is 67.
I hadn't met Shelley and the Tufnell. She was involved in the Tufnell Park Group or anyone there, but the Americans who came over were a very important influence, both the women and the men. And they were several years ahead in terms of recognizing the existence of the women's movement. And Henry himself had a very interesting political past. He'd been a sort of connection point between the old left and the new left in the States. He was dressed in a sort of hippie style at the back of the meeting. And I was trying to say to the guys, we need to have a jumble sale, because we haven't got any money. And they were thinking this jumble sale, reformism, I think they thought, reformism. But they were so stupid, because we needed to get some money and we could do a jumble sale. I'd done jumble sales in the Labour Party, I knew how to do them. And I was offering to do it, and they still kept ignoring. Anyway, they then said, after they finally said yes, that we could have a jumble sale, they never did organise that place that they said they would. That was meant to be their thing. Me and my friend Mary had it in our house in Montague Road.
Right, well, I wanted to talk about
but
that.
Henry did explain to me that what was happening, it was not just that people were irritated because I kept talking. It was because there was this thing that happened, and it was called male chauvinism, in which women got cut out and people forgot that they'd said anything and things like that. So it was it was absolutely amazing to hear that this was not just some personal thing about
wanting you to shut up.
Yes.
So back in that house in Montague Road, which interestingly was a time to recall when ordinary people could buy a house in inner London, and you and Bob ended up buying a house, but of course not charging rent, but everyone would put in £1 towards collective bills and £1 towards political activity of one's choice, no doubt, like that jumble sale. So those ideas of collective living are also something which have all but disappeared, partly because they've almost had to disappear, because it's so hard to get large housing that people could live in, let alone pay the bills through collecting £1 from whoever lived there. But it's an interesting time.
Our economic failure was that we never thought about repairs to the house. This was a missing thing. So the house did actually gradually disintegrate. And I can see lurking in a corner one of the members of this collective house with his head more or less kind of thing. This is Nigel Fountain, who introduced very strict rota when the hippies were finally moved out and order came. We did have some central order with the rota for tasks and shopping and things.
I mean, another thing that's also clear from your writing is how aware that there was a lot of class politics going on in the 60s, as in your teaching of the apprentices, who in the end go on the anti-Vietnam War march, don't they, many of them, and complain because they don't notice you on it amongst the 100,000 people who were there.
They were fed up because it divided, and the militants went to have to fight with the police. And the bulk of us, Tariq and all of us, we went into this to the orderly, we went on the orderly bit. And my apprentices who'd been supporting Enoch Powell not long ago said, "Where were you?" Because I hadn't gone on the militant.
Really interesting bit. Anyway, so then in 68 you join Black Dwarf, which Tariq Ali is editing, where you meet Sally Alexander, who will remain in.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Important influence and friend in your life. And, you know, still there's this same problem of being a woman on the left and the undertone of sexism everywhere, you know, when particularly when a couple of people decide they've got to spruce things up with porn and pin-ups and so on, and this doesn't actually appeal to you. So one of the first group meetings of women there is in the toilet. You often seem to end up in the ladies' toilet in those early days before women's liberation has actually emerged. And why, in fact, you'll leave Black Dwarf, which is interesting, is because they start to think of students as the vanguard. Because in 68, that's when you've got the occupations. And you object to the fact that they are now saying students are the vanguard. You don't think we should be thinking in terms of vanguards. And meanwhile, when you go off to speak to some of those vanguards, at LSE, for instance, in your miniskirt, they heckle and roar at you for wearing a miniskirt as you try and talk about the importance of FE colleges and the underfunding of FE colleges. And when you're in the next year, in 69, you go off to talk to the students in Essex, again, they throw toilet paper at you and things like that. So it's not so easy still being a woman on the left then, is it?
No, we had small groups in 69 in Britain. And those small groups were really important. And we were beginning to get stuff from America, but it was quite small still until after the first conference in 1970 in Oxford. The question of the pin-ups and the Black Dwarf is a little confusing because I am afraid there are several errors in my book. I'll have to confess to you this. One is that I said that Nigel Fountain was one of the people who suggested to Clive Goodwin that there should be pin-ups.
And David Widgery.
It was David Widgery, I think, in a joke.
It would have been
David Widgery making a joke, I think. But I got very, very angry about it and wrote a very angry poem that I stuck on the walls. But on the other hand, I did feel very ambiguous about the whole issue of pornography and nakedness and imagery, because we hated, one of the things we stuck stickers against was the very cheesy sort of adverts that were becoming very prevalent in the late 60s. And they were really so kind of contained. I mean, it was a sexuality that was formed by commerce, and we loathed it. But on the other hand, we were really committed to sexual freedom, a lot of us. And some of the stuff that was shown in the underground at concerts and things was really what could be defined as pornography. And the women who were working on the underground papers had to really think about that and discuss it. And without wanting to just dismiss all types of sexual imagery, we were really struggling about how do you think about the presentation of women. And I think that still is really a problem. How do you steer? Actually, Sue O'Sullivan wrote a very brilliant article about that in relation to lesbian sexuality in the 1980s in Feminist Review.
Upsetting the apple cart.
Yes, upsetting the apple cart. It was really interesting.
I think I better probably just have one last question so we can open to the floor. But at the end of 68, as you say, Tariq suggests you actually write something for Black Dwarf, and they produce the year. You produce the Year of the Militant Women, talking to the wife of the seaman who's been campaigning for better conditions for the fishermen, and also the Audrey Wise writing on the equal pay for Ford workers, and then you writing about something which seems to me is as significant today as it was then, although it seemed for a while to improve, and that is how we combine as women working lives with raising children and with care in general. This is the one issue that seems to me is no more solved today than it was then, although for a while things seemed to get a bit better. So I thought perhaps you could comment on that. But also, when you talk about in 1969, you leave Black Dwarf, you leave IS, and you want to be a part of this different space and different politics which women's liberation is going to produce and create in small groups where we can all listen to each other, we can all be heard, we'll have no leaders, we'll have no sectarianism, there'll be time and space to think about our visions of the future. What happened to that idea?
Well, we did it partially, and we did it, I think, fairly successfully for at least about 5 years. And then things began to get frayed. And the issue that they got frayed around really was relationship to men and whether we were connected to men politically or personally, or whether we were going to be completely apart from men and saw men as the main key problem, really. Those of us who eventually ended up being called socialist feminists, who'd been part of women's liberation, were arguing that we thought that the position of women was something that's connected to the oppression of other groups of people too. And we wanted to look at all those together. But other people said that's wrong because women always get pushed to the back and we need to focus primarily on women. And then that caused differences because sometimes women were saying we don't want men to come in support of us on the Women's Liberation March. And those of us who did think men should come would be saying that we wanted them to come. And so that because we didn't have a system by which we could make centralized decisions, what happens, and it's a very common problem in participatory democracy, I think, is that people with one lot would turn up, make a decision, then the next week another lot would come and make a decision until people got so cross and fed up. And so we did discover that our ways of trying to be democratic did themselves contain some problems.
Yes.
And that it isn't easy to create an absolute alternative. I think that's what happened to us, but it still was possible to remember that we'd organized in that different way and carry that memory on into other things that we'd were involved with.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of other tensions arose, particularly in more morbid times, with the success of Thatcher and with left hopes being rolled back. Then you also got not only debates over men and sexuality coming to, very much to the fore in the sex wars of the 80s, but also all sorts of other identity conflicts around, in particular, race and other issues. But I think maybe we better open it up and that might come back.
I'm quite interested in the state of the union movement at the moment. It feels to me like it's definitely in decline, and I was just wondering whether you'd be able to elaborate at all on the relationship between the women's liberation movement and the union movement at the time, and whether that has any bearing on the situation today.
We really wanted to have as strong as possible connection, and I remember that one of the meetings to plan the 1970 conference, I was plugging away to ask a woman called Audrey Wise to come. She did come and speak at the 1970 conference, but she got involved. She was a former Trotskyist, actually, who'd gone into the Labour Party and was not initially totally sympathetic to women's liberation. But because she came into contact with us, she changed. And she eventually became a Labour MP who was arrested at Grunwicks. And she became this important connection. There was another woman called Gertie Roche in Leeds who was one of the leaders of the clothing workers' strike and who was also a friend of Claudia Jones, the woman who came from... she's originally from the Caribbean, but then from the States, and was a very important figure in the development of black groups in Britain and the Notting Hill Carnival. And that connection is interesting. That predated women's liberation. But the connections, the things that I think historians who look in a superficial way often miss, and the connections that are just all the time, because the immediate thing to do is you get a women's liberation group in Sheffield and they went off to talk about the need for free contraception at the factory gates. And the women really joked because they said to the women from Sheffield, they said, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning, you must be joking. But so we were very keen and zealous, but we perhaps didn't always go about it in the best way. And I think the ways in which the connections came was through, in the unions, it was through women campaigning for women's liberation through their own unions, which happened slightly later, sort of 74-ish. And also the rise of community activism, in which there were lots of women who were very committed to grassroots community activism in terms of housing and co-ops, food co-ops and things like that, who worked in local communities.
Yes, also, just as the 60s has been written out of much history, even more so, I think, so is the 70s and the women's liberation movement and our emergence out of the left. If you read Lorna Finlayson in the latest New Left Review, it's as though feminists never knew anything about class, apart from Angela Davis. And so, you know, we also have to keep retrieving our memories to try and think about what happened. But I'm going to take comments from a few people now, since we haven't got much time.
You're mentioning the phrase male chauvinism feels takes me back, because it's not a phrase that we use now.
That's right, I couldn't remember.
No, but how interesting, because what it made me think of was how feminists more recently have theorised around patriarchy. And that theorizing has enabled us to maybe move on from that dichotomy that you're describing of men being in one place and women, and those things that divided, I think, the women's movement through the 70s, should boys be allowed into the creche and all that sort of stuff that we got so heated about, which was
some
because we didn't have, yes, some of us, and some of us said, oh God, for God's sake, it's not here nor there. But I wondered what you felt about that theorising around patriarchy and how that has moved us on. I wonder.
Just at the time in the 70s when you're kind of part of IS and also thinking about local activism, reflecting upon those international socialist groups, but also like bridging the with the women's movement, thinking about a kind of new form of politics. I guess my question is, what was the society that you were imagining? What were the kind of, was it Britain? Was it Europe? Was it something broader than that? Or imagining it from the kind of grassroots activism that you were doing?
Two questions, comments. Sheila, at the end of your talk, you alluded to something that made me think of Joe Freeman's notion of the tyranny of structurelessness in the feminist movement, at least in America. Would you apply that to the British scene as well? Was it it's an early critique.
Yeah,
of super democratic, horizontal forms of organizing, which some people have also now attached to Occupy and others. And the second question actually comes from Lynn Siegel's comment. Would you agree that, well, both of you, would you agree that sort of class has been written out of more contemporary versions of feminism? I mean, I spend time in America and I feel that intersectionality has written class out. It's actually focused on everything other than class. Would you agree? Thank you.
It was following on from what you said in a way. I wondered what you thought about, you know, feminism now, because it seems to me there are kind of, you know, fissures and rifts and schisms within it. What has happened to feminism? Not just the feminist project, but, you know, you're talking about feminism in America or in such, you know, where class has been kind of superseded. There are lots of things, I guess, in this country as well. And I just wonder what you want to say about feminism like now, you know. Sheila.
Well, I sort of begin with you because I formed a friendship with a woman who was a socialist feminist from India called Radha Kumar, who I met, I think, about late 70s. Mm. And through Radha, I heard that she'd been in some sexual politics resistance faction of the International Marxist Group in Delhi. And they'd had the same argument or something. So that was the amazing, weird thing about the Trotskyist little groups, that they were internationalist. And our internationalism followed that kind of internationalism. I think we were concerned to be connected to feminists in other countries and to left movements in other countries, but we didn't see that necessarily in terms of how race was being talked about in the States, because there was connections anyway. There were global links to connections. And I feel that class has vanished, and I get exasperated by this. I've just found that a book has recently been written on class and women's liberation movement, which I can't remember. It's by a man, and I can't remember his name, but it's quite interesting. So that's a good sign that somebody is making that connection, because it was the actual opposite in the 1960s, that everybody would talk about class and never talk about race or homosexuality, women. It was, or certainly not trans. I mean, there was no way in which you could kind of get through. It was just seen where you'd get class sorted out and then these other things all follow, and we would be battering our heads against that. But on the other hand, the things that have actually happened to working class people have been so extreme and dire in the period since certainly 1979. And those experiences are ones that remain hidden and I think feed into a very deep bitterness in working class communities, which becomes a kind of negativity against the possibility of any optimistic change. It's a very deep feeling of being abandoned, really. And it's a deep anxiety to me that people recognize that these connections have existed in the past, and they are really important. I I don't agree with the concept of patriarchy. I've written about this since 1979. I find it another exasperating idea because I think it presents a vision of a fixed notion of male power, which doesn't show the fact that there have been enormous distinctions. I mean, if you were an Anglo-Saxon woman, you had a much better deal than you did when the Normans came, you know. There has been variations of the male chauvinism, or whatever it should be called, the male dominance that has existed in every recorded society that we know of. But I don't see patriarchy and talking about patriarchy as a very helpful way to get through that, because I think it presents a notion of a fixed structure which exists apart from history.
Some of us disagree profoundly.
Yes. For different reasons, though, you guys. Yeah. You like patriarchy.
It's not fixed. It's not fixed. It's relational. Yes. It's constantly.
Well, I agree in the relational. Yeah. Relational, yes.
About how we saw the future, was it very European-based?
Initially, the women's movement was in some ways, but actually I noticed Anna Davin came in at the back, yeah. And I remember there was the history shrew very early on, I think, is it 1969, 70? Yes. And that was about international women's struggles, yes. But it was as we saw things in terms of movements of resistance in which women took part, which were anti-imperialist movement.
Solidarity.
And there's that extraordinary piece by Mary Kelly in that issue.
Yes.
On women's liberation and national liberation.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's really worth looking at again, actually, if you have access to it.
There was small women's groups that formed in Islington, there was a small women's group that was actually like a Black Panther group too. So that was very early. But I don't know what happened to that group. It met in Islington.
Yeah, I remember. Anyone else burning to say something?
But can I just add that the main way that Asian and Caribbean women came in contact with women's movement was through the practical activity rather than the consciousness-raising groups. And that was the same with working-class white women, actually, that whatever we did, it wasn't very... They didn't seem to want to come and sit talking. Although Essex Road Women's Centre, I think, did do women's health, and they was a way of talking about personal.
But we did talk about racism in schools and the SUS laws, and also anti-immigration struggles. We're trying to deport wives whose husbands had left them, or something else had happened to the husbands. There was a lot of activism went on around anti-racism, but then race gets theorized differently from the 80s as a type of, you know, post-colonial consciousness that it becomes another issue.
So from the kind of feminist organizing spaces I've been in Sheffield and Cambridge mostly, it's called, like, people talk a lot about legacy work and kind of the politics of remembering and how we need to acknowledge and respect our indebtedness to the women who came before in those organizing spaces and kind of open them up to us. And it's always presented as a very kind of liberatory thing. But I feel like it can often be used actually to blinker us as well. And I was just wondering, because I feel like a lot of what you've written hinges on the misrepresentation since, and kind of what gets remembered and what doesn't. How do you feel like the legacy of the women's lib movement has most been skewed, kind of, I suppose?
It's really nice if people are interested in what we did and do want to look into it, but don't get too bothered about it. Just get on with things, because we've all got a bit tired as we've got older. So it's very important that there's new ones around.
I remember reading Women's Consciousness, Men's World, and I really loved when you quoted The Velvet Underground against Simone de Beauvoir. And I just wondered if you had any other like songs or music that takes you back to the 60s and 70s.
Oh. I mean, I realised when I was reading it again that there is quite a lot of references to music. And I mean, music was all around, and sometimes at full volume and driving me crazy, because I lived with a wooden door dividing me between various musicians who were playing music, and I was trying to write my thesis on working class adult education in the 19th century.
Oh yes, I forgot about that.
But music was part of our feelings. I mean, I hadn't realized until I read some book about the Beatles when I was doing this book, and everything I thought was, you know, some original thought that I'd had, I was realizing, well, it's actually there in quite a lot of the songs, you know, that we were taking stuff in unconsciously from an ethos, and the underground and the culture that was around us was really important, because it was expressing inner kinds of aspirations for some other way of being, which was part of what we were saying from a political point of view. We wanted another way to be in society and in relation to other people.
You also, when you talked about, and I remember well how ignorant we were about sex, because we have no language particularly, and we still have little language really that feels good to talk about women's bodies. And you talked about, rightly, the influence of Bessie Smith, Juliet Gréco, and forgotten the other one you mentioned, that they're not altogether helpful, but they are sexy and raunchy. At least we knew, you know, they could turn us on, even if trying to develop that language to describe women's desire and women's sexuality was so hard to find. I think it's still fairly hard to find, actually.
I don't know if people know what... I mean, Juliet Gréco was very slender and dark. I longed to look like Juliet Gréco. It was completely hopeless, as I was kind of always sort of curvy and gingerish and freckly.
Odetta was another one.
Yeah.
She was bigger, Odetta.
We sort of snatched women from the past because we didn't really know who we could relate to. And our sense of ourselves didn't really fit things that even somebody, you know, in an earlier generation like Simone de Beauvoir was writing. So I do think that every generation has to make a women's movement again. But on the other hand, I'm a historian and I love to find out what people were doing in the past. I just delight in that.
This might contradict what you just said about not being too dutiful about remembering the past. But do you think that, I mean, just thinking about the present in light of the Me Too moment in feminism, do you think this is actually a good moment for feminism to sort of rediscover the insights of the women's movement from the 60s and 70s? That in a way there's been a rediscovery, to use your word, of male chauvinism. It's sheer fact. A generation of women who thought we had dealt with it are again faced with this bald fact again. I don't know.
Well, the forms of it that were described by people through the Me Too movement were so grotesque and horrific, actually. I mean, we had problems, but there was... Also, there was some kind of protective ideas about how people should behave. And the behavior, I mean, how people, I think probably that people in the theater and in films, that women were always very vulnerable. But it was very surreptitious and secret, whereas nowadays it seems to become so blatant, and that arouse the initial anger. But I mean, I felt angry before women's liberation developed. And when, as soon as we started talking to one another and felt that power of collectivity and being able to think through things together, I ceased to feel that rage. And I think it's really hard, because if you have just anger, you don't actually create something. You can denounce, but you don't make something new. So I don't quite know. Anger is something that starts, but you need to find something else. You need to find a power that can hold on to yourself and link up with other people and be able to face people without just defying. I don't know if that's very
coherent. I'd like to add something about the context as well. I mean, we're living in a time of enormous anger and resentment, which is being encouraged and, of course, always racialized, among other things. But in your book, Sheila, there's an amazing account of the attempted rape that you experienced from an Algerian worker, in which you're at the very same time as it's happening and you're fighting it off. It's the most extraordinary account of a rape and its aftermath, rather different from Edouard Louis, but with overlaps to his account of being raped as a gay man. You're aware when suddenly you make him laugh and the rape doesn't happen, and then he becomes more protective of you, and you see the contempt with which he is seen with a white woman. It's you know, you are trying to contextualize that very incredibly almost violent experience that has happened. It was a violent experience.
Yes. I mean, now I think, good heavens, I should be able to cope with this. But I was, I mean, partly it was my ignorance, I think, my complete ignorance about, and I was
of the danger.
I was so determined. Well, yes, and I had been this sort of lower middle class Leeds thing. You must be polite. So I
please don't do this.
No, I met him because I was trying to find a trunk that my father and mother had sent from Turnbull's in Leeds. So I ended up in a place which was being built up at the edge of Paris, and I asked an elder woman the way, and she handed me over to this young man, and I began to feel anxious because he kept sort of taking me and trying to get me to drink alcohol, and I kept saying, no, 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 and I would have a coffee. So I had a black coffee, and this went on, and I was getting very anxious about finding my trunk, so that this saga developed into which he presumably assumed that I was interested in him. I just didn't know how to get away. And
And you were speaking in French.
Yes, I must say the French, it was fairly early on in my time in Paris, and I was 17. So the French was, school French was suddenly coming into my head.
Anyway, context matters, that's all.
I just wanted to ask you what you were saying about channeling anger. And you feel that in this current day, that should be easier than ever to do with social media. But we are facing a period of Trump and Bolsonaro and right-wing populist men, where abortion rights are being rolled back, where a woman in America is now being prosecuted of the death of her unborn baby because she was shot in the stomach. Mm. And it feels like that we should have a greater call to action. And social media feels to me like an echo chamber, and that just to say it is enough, and it isn't actually leading to the action that it should. How
There's
do you feel about
that? Also such pressing need. I mean, the situation of our health service, the situation of the education for working class, care. Every aspect of any basic social democratic welfare has been assailed.
That's right.
And at the same time, there is this terrible poverty of people in Britain who are working, people who are actually working, going to food banks, which you all know about. And I think there's a terrible way in which you find, or one finds, that you just can't take it in. I mean, I end up sometimes hearing reports of suffering to the extent that I feel like curling up because I don't know what to do about it alone. But Val remembers working with Kumari Jayawardena, who wrote on feminism and nationalism in the third world in Wider. And Kumari once said to me, you know, you in the West, you've got this idea of the fist, but we have this idea of the open hand, of passing on power. And somehow, perhaps that's the way to get the anger to go outwards into something collective, which can then be created into how movements arise. But to say how it is that a movement actually coalesces and arises seems to be very difficult. And it doesn't always come because there's so many things going wrong.
How it arises and forms coalitions in order to try and get some of those things changed, I'd say. Okay. Thank you, Sheila.
Thank you for joining us for this London Review Bookshop event. For more, visit our website at www.londonreviewbookshop.co.uk or search for the London Review Bookshop on iTunes.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.